Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law and Civil Rights Practice Groups, was recorded on Monday, December 5, 2016, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to a special Federalist Society Courthouse Steps telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing this morning's Supreme Court oral arguments in Bethune Hill v. Virginia State Board of Elections and McCrory v. Harris. My name is Nate Kaczmarek. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we welcome our expert, Maya Narona, who is an associate with Baker & Hostetler. I will turn it over to Maya to get us started. Following opening remarks, we will open the floor for audience questions. So please think of questions you would like to ask Maya. Thank you for speaking with us, Maya. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Thanks to the Federalist Society for hosting this call. I'd like to go over a little background of redistricting law, then talk about the issues that are in these two cases, and then talk about the Supreme Court oral arguments that I attended this morning. So after the 2000 census showing changes in population over the United States, the Republican state legislatures in North Carolina and Virginia redrew their districts to comply with the one-person, one-vote requirement. So each district had has the same amount of population. So in redistricting, maps must also comply with various requirements, such as the Voting Rights Act, where racial minorities must be able to have to elect a representative of their choice. Then there's also a Supreme Court case, Shaw, that held that the Equal Protection Clause is violated when states use race as the predominant factor in the drawing of districts. And then there's also traditional redistricting requirements that the maps must comply with, like compactness, contiguity, and keeping communities of interest together. So the two cases were Bethune Hill and Harris v. McCrory. So in Bethune Hill versus Virginia State Board of Elections, in 2015, plaintiffs challenged Virginia's districts that had been drawn in 2011 after the 2010 census, and they alleged a Shaw violation. The Virginia plan was drawn with each district having a racial target, a 55% black voting age percentage, to comply with the Voting Rights Act. The court did not apply strict scrutiny to this percentage threshold, so the meaning of racial predominance was an issue, and the court ruled that race cannot predominate unless the use of race results in an actual conflict with traditional redistricting criteria. So the plaintiffs argued that a black voting age population threshold should trigger strict scrutiny without showing that traditional redistricting principles have been violated, because otherwise states can use those requirements as a pretext for racial discrimination. Then in the North Carolina case, plaintiffs challenged two of North Carolina's legislative districts drawn after the 2000 census. And these two districts have been part of litigation five times before the Supreme Court. In the past. So one was a majority minority district and the other one was another district. So the lower court had found that these two districts were racially discriminatory because race predominated in the drawing of the districts under the Equal Protection Clause, another Shaw violation case. So North Carolina argued they were simply relying on 50% plus one of African Americans in the majority minority district, and they were complying with the Voting Rights Act. So the court applied strict scrutiny, requiring that the state demonstrate that the majority-minority district was actually necessary to use consider race, instead of simply showing it had good reasons to believe that the districts did not dilute the votes of African Americans. The other district, the state argued that it was politics, not race, and they relied on a case called Cromartie, where districts in North Carolina had also been, but they had been validated as permissible under the Constitution. Furthermore, plaintiffs argued that the court did not require plaintiffs to provide an alternative plan that is consistent with traditional redistricting principles and pursues the legislative objectives, but brings about greater balance, which is an argument the defendants made. So today's arguments, I attended the arguments, Bethune Hill was first, and then McCrory case came second. It was interesting because Paul Clement and Mark Elias argued both cases. Paul Clement represented the legislatures of North Carolina and Virginia, and then Mark Elias of Perkins Coie represented the challengers to each of those redistricting plans. And they argued that African Americans, the case was African American population tends to correlate with those who belong to Democratic Party. So that correlation was an issue, whether that was racially discriminatory in both of those cases. So in the Virginia case's oral arguments, Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito both drilled down on what the meaning of racial predominance was. And they both asked a lot of questions about whether you need to have an actual conflict with redistricting principles when it's difficult to tell whether it's race or whether it's another redistricting principle. How do you make that determination? So what Paul Clement for Virginia argued that racial predominance was the sacrifice of redistricting principles. So that's what it means to be a predominant factor. So he distinguished a Shaw claim, which was the racial predominance factor, from other redistricting vote dilution claims. So also in the Virginia case, Justin Kagan was asking about how the black voting age population percentage was used by Virginia, how that wouldn't be race-based decision-making. So Paul Clement contrasted the 55% black voting age population number because it's as close to 50% plus one, which is required by the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act involved some consideration of race. So that was an issue that allowed, in that case, to factor race into the calculus. And 55% gave a differential for the districts to have a little bit more, a little bit less, depending on how their population balanced out. Then in the North Carolina case, we got questions from Justice Kagan about why the plaintiffs need to show that an alternative map must be drawn when there is evidence of race, because there was a large population of African Americans that moved from one district to another. So in response, the North Carolina argument was that it would place a large burden on state legislators in drawing their maps if they had to indicate that if they didn't have an alternative map to show that they weren't relying on race, another map could be drawn. So Paul Clement explained that one of the districts in North Carolina was based on presidential statistics, and in that district, race was not even considered. So the only consideration of race was in the second district, which was a majority-minority, and it was to cross-check that the Voting Rights Act wasn't violated. So in both cases, the issue of what involvement the judiciary should play in redistricting cases was at the backdrop. So, and how does a state legislature make these decisions about how to comply with, you know, constitutional requirements and other requirements, traditional redistricting criteria in the full analysis? So the question is there's an opportunity for abuse from potential plaintiffs, especially in such a political decision as redistricting. So one of the questions was, can we use now Shaw as a weapon to litigate lots of different cases? Just when parties change power, you'll try to increase how many districts that belong to a particular party, but have them be safe districts. And then when the party changes, they might just change the whole map so that it favors another party. So should courts really be involved in deeply re-guessing all of these factors? And it seemed like the court at the oral arguments wanted to have some sort of standard so these cases wouldn't keep coming back five times like we saw the North Carolina districts. So there's the element of politics that came up. And we saw in North Carolina the argument was that the census was in 2010, and then the case came up in 2011. But the litigation didn't start until 2015. And in Virginia, as you know, the governor changed from a Republican to a Democrat. So there's that partisan element that if the redistricting maps were struck down by a court, then it would be a Democrat who could veto and change the maps to make them more favorable to one party over another. So we have this partisan element and the courts now being involved to deal with racial discrimination and the question of when it's race and when it's not, and when it's politics and when it's not. So I'll turn it over to questions now. Thanks.
Okay, Maya, thank you very much. I will now open the floor for questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound sign. While our audience members are lining up in the queue, Maya, I thought I would ask, do you have a sense, based on listening to oral argument this morning, what way the court is going to go on these cases?
Well, I have a sense that since we have without Justice Scalia, it might end up becoming a 4-4, so there might be a push for the court to consider remanding on factual issues to come to a greater have more information about what factors may have shown racial predominance in each of these cases. And then in the North Carolina case, there's also the question of a North Carolina Supreme Court case, which conflicted with the federal case. And in Virginia, there's also a state case going on. So maybe the justices would decide under res judicata to just let the other decision stand and not even get involved on these constitutional questions.
Okay, very good. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Our usual reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming telephone calls. You can consult the full schedule of our upcoming telephone conference calls on the Federal Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded calls. Okay, Maya, we have our first question of the afternoon from the audience. Let's go to that now.
Maya, these redistricting cases are always complex politically. Can you sort of lay out for us where the Republicans come down, where the Democrats come down, and why the Solicitor General was supporting vacating the lower court decision?
Well, these cases are very factually intensive. So the Solicitor General was arguing to try to develop a standard. In the Virginia case, he wanted to develop, he argued in favor of developing a standard with actual conflict because that would show that there was some workable standard to evaluate whether a redistricting case was valid or not. But there's a concern at the back of this that too strong a Shaw standard would almost make the Voting Rights Act unconstitutional. So trying to find that balance is where all of the parties are trying to argue on and decide. I wouldn't say that there's one approach of one party or the other, though they might favor a certain way, majority-minority districts and drawn in a certain way to favor one side, one party or not, depending on how the population is in the particular state. So it's very factually intensive how each party might argue it. And sometimes you might find they're arguing different sides on different cases, whether they're defending a district or challenging a district.
Would I be wrong concluding, though, that the Republicans would prefer to have a 55% floor on majority-minority districts because that would concentrate more African-American voters in those districts and make the surrounding districts less African-American?
That was an allegation alleged, what some people call packing and cracking. There is the concern to protect a redistricting plan against Voting Rights Act. So there is some sort of, some election law practitioners call it a Goldilocks principle of where to draw that line. So in the Alabama case that was in the last term, it was a black voting age population of 80-90%. So that was definitely a sign where, a voting age percentage of that was so exceeding the amounts that it should be that it was struck down. Whereas here we only had 55% in Virginia, and then North Carolina had 50% plus one, very minimal. So it depends on what percentage you're arguing. In this case, also, the plaintiffs were arguing that there was a crossover district. So even less than 50 50% would constitute the ability of a minority to elect representatives of their choice. So that's very difficult for a court to evaluate and speculate based on past voting data what in the future some voters might actually be able to elect their districts. And then redistricting involves a lot of computer analysis and plans. So there's also the concern of how much data we're asking these legislators to surf through to make an assessment of where how much of a population to have in a certain place or not, and how the demographics keep changing every 10 years.
All right, thank you.
Okay, Maya, we have another caller waiting in the queue to ask a question. If you would like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone.
My question is this. I know that there was coverage last week of a three-judge panel from North Carolina's ruling that they needed to redraw the state house map by March. I'm assuming that the case you're talking about is not the state house map. How do the two interrelate? What map did this affect? And are they pulling in the same direction or in different directions?
Well, it's more complicated than that in North Carolina. They're both state legislature maps, but the state legislature in North Carolina, when their map was struck down by the lower court case, they went back and drew another map. So there's another line of cases that's going up to the Supreme Court, and there was a cert petition, and that's the challenge to that new map is that it's partisan gerrymandering, which is different from racial gerrymandering.
Okay, very good. Just another reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign. We currently don't have anyone in the queue. The lines are wide open. I'll offer one last call for questions. In the interim, I will announce that this Thursday, the Federalist Society will be hosting a live program entitled The Limits of Federal Criminal Law at the National Press Club. That'll be at 12 p.m., and that program will go to 2 p.m. Featured on that panel will be Christina Arguedas, Leslie R. Caldwell from DOJ, Benjamin Hatch, John Richter, Joseph Savage, and Stuart Taylor is going to be the moderator. Should be a great panel. You can still sign up to attend live, and also just announced we will be live streaming that event from our blog website, the Federal Society blog website. Again, that's this Thursday, December 8th at noon, and that's a program on over-criminalization. You can check out more information about that event at our website. Maya, looks like we have two additional callers with questions ready. Let's go to the next question.
Yes, my question is this. We just had the 2016 elections. I guess we only have one or two more elections until this redistricting starts all over again. Is there any possibility the court would declare all this moot and kick it down to the next round of reapportionment, or is it still a hot issue this late into the decade?
Well, the court will probably render a decision this term, probably towards the later end of the term. So it would be next year they make some sort of decision. But they might potentially, if they choose to, because it's a 4-4 court, potentially punt it till next term if there's a ninth person on the court to break the tie. But I don't think it's likely they'll continue it until the next district, because they'll have to get some plan in place. And North Carolina has currently their existing plan is struck down, and then their subsequent plan is being challenged. So they're in search of some plan so that they have it for this upcoming election.
Okay, Maya, very good. We have one person currently waiting for the next question. Let's go to that question now.
Hi, good afternoon. My question is, if this decision is indeed a 4-4, like you say it might be, How do you think it'll end up once it goes back to remand?
Well, I think these cases are so fact-intensive that the lower court might try to determine what the predominant standard is. And in Virginia, they have the actual conflict prism that they're looking through it. So if it doesn't match the general traditional redistricting criteria, then it would stand, and they had held that it was. Whereas if there isn't really a standard that the court has found, the North Carolina decision would stand, which struck down the plan, and that was based on how they interpreted the legislators' motives in passing this plan, how they considered race in terms of all the different redistricting criteria.
Okay, looks like our lines are open. If you would like to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound sign on your telephone keypad. Maya, it looks like we have exhausted all the questions. Are there additional comments you'd like to make regarding oral arguments this morning, or any other concluding remarks you'd like to offer our audience?
Well, just to sum up, something of interest to the Federal Society in particular is the role of the courts in this process and how involved they should be. So it's something every Federalist should be looking at and thinking about. Thanks.
Very good. On behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank Maya Narona for joining us today. We welcome listener feedback at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.